May it please the court, I am Dennis Polk, P-O-L-K. My attorney registration number is 8777. I appear on behalf of the defendant, Appellant. I would like to address essentially three primary issues with the court, if I may reserve a portion of my time for rebuttal. First issue that I think is pivotal in determination of, from which all other significant error in this case results, is that respectfully, the trial court, in my view, applied the wrong statute of limitations to this issue. The underlying basis for this entire claim has to do with a document that is called an indemnity agreement. I think it is significant, and that is before the court in various places, but it is significant because that document itself parallels the very language of the appropriate statute of limitations. And what I'm talking about there is what I'll generically call the construction defect statute of limitations. And why I say that is that statute, by its term, refers to improvements to real property. A careful reading of this indemnity agreement also refers to and almost uses the same language, improvements to real property. If we look at the whereas recitals in the underlying indemnity agreement that form the basis of this claim, it parallels that statute. We must assume that, as between these relatively sophisticated parties, they must have had an understanding or concept of what the statute of limitations was. It's also significant because the indemnity agreement that is before the court refers to a two-year period. It is commensurate and runs parallel with the very statute of limitations that we're talking about. And so, therefore, when you look at this, I think the trial court found itself in an odd position because it's wanting to say that this thing is neither fish nor fowl, but then it leaps to the next step and says, we're going to apply the general contract statute of limitations, which leads me to my sort of second area of what I respectfully submit was error by the trial court. And that is that the trial court in this instance respectfully applied the wrong accrual date under either the construction defect statute of limitations, which is a two-year from physical manifestation.
So before you go on to that point, doesn't the Supreme Court's decision in Hirsch pretty well dispose of your first argument?
I respectfully disagree, because if we look at the actual language, Hirsch is very fact-dependent. And Hirsch deals with an express warranty period. It has a five-year period of performance in Hirsch. That is a contractual obligation. It uses the term warranty. I will repair or replace within that five-year period. That is truly distinct from the issue that is before you, because here, the provisions of the construction defect statute say it doesn't matter what theory we're approaching it under, and it even uses the word indemnity. So that's why I think it's different.
But under this contract, it's like a warranty because the your client is to pay for any repairs up to $125,000.
Judge, I respectfully disagree. That is the, again, what I submit is the error of the trial court. The trial court says this is repair
and replace. Section 2 and 3 set forth a very definite contractual scheme the parties have worked out where if Excel sees a problem, it provides notice, and then your client can go in and investigate and test and make repairs, or if it doesn't make repairs, then Excel goes in and makes repairs, and then the money is to be paid out of escrow either to Excel or to WCCM, whichever one made the repairs.
Well, it doesn't use those words, Your Honor, and that's the critical distinction with Hirsch.
It says work.
Well, what it says is subject to, in accordance with the terms and conditions, and that is a term and condition, that WCM agrees to defend, indemnify, and hold harmless. That is truly factually and legally distinct. These are terms of art. Factually and legally distinct from the language in Hertz that says repair or replace and uses the word warranty. That is a substantial difference.
But you look at the entire language of the contract. There is one provision that has the indemnity language, but then there are two very lengthy sections that do go into a lengthy. They may not use the words repair, but they certainly talk about doing the work to fix the problems. And isn't that the same situation?
I respectfully submit it isn't, because let's look at that language. And this agreement is a good, better, otherwise. It speaks in terms, if you look at it, and, you know, I take great pride in saying I didn't draft it, because it does create those inherent issues. But if you look at it, much like any other policy of indemnity, even if it's an insurance policy, it has what I'm going to use vernacularly, insuring agreement. That is, I will save, hold harmless, and indemnify you upon the following terms and conditions. And those are found in subparagraph 1, indemnity. It's important because the recital also refers to that. And then there's a provision that says terms, conditions, and limitations. Those are words limiting the broader scope of indemnity. There must be some triggering event. And even if we look at this, notice and not notice, and who has what right, if we look at it, it says if XL in subparagraph B provides written notice of an event. An event, then, is a defined term, and you've got to look at the exhibit to the agreement, because what's important is while this sale was going on, there was actually active litigation going on in the federal court brought by one of these tenants that they're talking about.
That's just, the exhibit is merely examples of an event. Event is defined in Section 2A.
Section 2A defines what an event is.
And it says including but not limited to the items listed on Exhibit A, which picks up what you're talking about. It's not limited to those things.
But it says which falls within the scope of this indemnity, and that is a term of limitation or condition.
If Excel had contracted to make these repairs with a number of vendors, and the repairs were made, and then Excel had collected all the bills and sent them on to your client, would you have been liable to pay those bills, assuming that they were under $125,000?
Depends at what point in time, and no, I don't believe so, because there has to be something that triggers the words defend, indemnify, hold harmless. Because this isn't just a blanket agreement that we will repair for the cost of repair. It is an obligation of indemnity. And that is different than saying, if you have to make these repairs. And why that's important is if you look at the underlying structure of this agreement, it also provides that, and it becomes important because you have to remember, Excel released somebody who had liability in this that was out there, and that's part of the factual record. Because this provided that in the event such a claim was made, my client would have the right to go back after the tenant or the people who had made warranties. But because of the passage of time and the circumstances that happened with regard to releasing the underlying events, no, we couldn't have gone back after those people.
In the underlying purchase and sale agreement, did your client make warranties?
They did make certain representations and warranties, and this is actually in the record before the court. There was a negotiated reduction in the purchase price based upon certain physical conditions of defect existing at the property. And they proceeded to close, reduce the purchase price accordingly, and then entered into this indemnity agreement as part of an accommodation of closing. So, yes, there were warranties, and no, they didn't proceed under that because of those circumstances. The next issue that I wanted to address, again, is I think the trial court, for whatever reason, simply wrote out of existence the literal words of this agreement, though it found it. The words that I think are significant are found in paragraph 1, where it says WCCM, my client, agrees to defend, indemnify, and hold harmless from and against any and all losses, damages. Those are words of indemnity, not words of repair. The trial court simply said this is a liquidated damages agreement, and it simply did not comport with the literal language of this contract. It writes those words out of existence.
Is it your position that because the word indemnify appears that this is limited exclusively to third-party claims?
What it is limited to, again, it's not just simply the word indemnity, Your Honor, with all due respect. It is the words agrees to defend, indemnify, and hold harmless from and against. That implies that there is
all losses, right?
Any and all losses. At what point in time did a loss occur that wasn't part of this prior agreement? It surely had to contemplate some action by some third party, a triggering event. There is no evidence of a triggering event.
There's no reference in here at all to third party claims, is there, in the agreement?
Well, you and I have sort of skirted around that issue, and I respectfully believe that the terms and provisions starting in paragraphs 2A, where it talks about an event, is an indication that there had to be some third party activity
an event,
triggering.
But an event the word event does not incorporate third-party activity.
Well, it does, I think when you look.
It could be more broad.
I think when you look in the context of this agreement in the Exhibit A, where it refers to schedule of events, that one or the more of the following may constitute a pre-existing event under this indemnity agreement. And I think that that.
One of them, the first one listed is floor tile and drywall cracking at Circuit City store.
But then, when you couple that with the notion that is found in paragraphs 2B, to C, to E, it had to mean something. And what it has to mean is in its common ordinary sense. The word indemnity in Colorado has a specialized meaning, and that is a claim or assertion made by a third party for which you may be liable.
And what's your authority for that?
Pardon me?
What's your authority for that?
I have it set forth in the brief, and I will find it for you.
I mean, the cases you cited, I think mid-century or something like that, was the indemnification clause explicitly referred to third-party claims.
Now, that is one of the cases, and I believe that the definition that I was talking about was the one set forth in my brief in Blacks.
Well, and in Blacks, the definition is, one of the definitions is a contract by which the promisor agrees to reimburse the promisee for some loss irrespective of a third party's liability. That's from your.
Well, I respectfully believe that under this document and under mid-century, there has to be a triggering event. We can respectfully probably agree to disagree then, Your Honor. The other thing that I want to focus on for just a moment, because I see my time is fast escaping me, is in either event, the statute of limitations, whether you apply the construction defect or you apply the contract standard, expired. The trial court, early on, a different judge said the six-year limitation. This trial court said the three-year statute of limitation applied. But then it used as an accrual date something that wasn't argued by either party, and that was the date on which payment was stopped under a payment made under a settlement or an attempted settlement of that, saying that that constituted the accrual date. And if you look at factually what happened, even if you don't accept the construction defect, you accept the three-year contract statute of limitation, and you pick any of the dates that the plaintiff in this made demand. They started making their demand in June of 2008, or I'm sorry, 1998, I apologize. 1998, they made another demand, including in May of the following year. No matter how you calculate that, is the accrual. My client didn't pay, didn't do what they said. And so therefore, that is what triggers the claim breach. That's more than 3 years after the filing of this action on September of 2003. No matter how you calculate it under either statute, that is the wrong date. And that is a question that I respectfully believe that this court should review de novo, because those are undisputed facts. In fact, they are basically in the stipulated facts. And the trial court came up with this notion that when they stopped payment on a check that they had written almost a year before in an effort to settle and compromise this issue, that is what accrued the running of the statute of limitations. And that's well beyond any possible time period. So respectfully, Your Honors, this case should be reversed on those three bases. I'm happy to answer any other questions, and if I may reserve the balance of my time, I would appreciate it.
Thank you, Counsel.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is John Bernhardt, registration number 20227, and I represent Appellee XL. Let me first turn to the first point that Mr. Polk raised, which is the focus on this being an indemnity contract and that being a term of art. As Judge Miller pointed out, the indemnity clause, paragraph 1, refers to an obligation to hold harmless, among other things, from and against any and all losses or damages. And WCCM would have the court stop at the word indemnity, but the contract goes on for a couple pages after that and explains exactly what the parties intended was going to happen. And in Section 2, it requires that XL give notice to WCCM if there is an event defined in the contract. And then Section 2A sub 2 authorizes WCCM to perform such remedial or curative work as may be required. And then moving on down to Section 2D, D like dog, It provides that if WCCM fails to fix a problem that arises, that XL may proceed to fix it itself. It then moves on into Section 3, where it describes how the funds in the reimbursement account are going to be disposed of, and basically it says whoever pays to fix a repair gets reimbursed out of the escrow account. And it says nothing about needing a claim by a third party. It says nothing that has anything to do with the language of Black's Law Dictionary. It says if a problem arises, we give notice, they fix it. If they don't fix it, we do. Whoever fixes it gets paid out of the escrow account. That's what the contract is about. The word indemnity is not the end of the contract. The second point that was raised is the issue of when the claim accrued. And I actually have a couple points on that. The first is, once again, sticking with the three-year statute of limitations, which the trial court applied, the lawsuit was filed on September 18, 2003, which means that the three-year trigger date would be September 18 of 2000. And if XL's claim accrued on or after September 18, 2000, then it's timely within the three-year contract statute. To figure out when the claim accrues, again, we have to turn to the party's contract. And what we're claiming is that we made some repairs because WCCM didn't, and then the last step of the contract, which was we're supposed to be reimbursed, is where the breach occurred. We did the work. We turned to the escrow account. The escrow account had been emptied out by WCCM. There was nothing there to reimburse us. So I would argue that really the effective date of accrual of the claim is when our claim was completed and we were damaged, when we incurred expenses and could not be reimbursed.
Can I ask you a question about the check that I guess was originally issued and then they stopped payment on it? And as I understand it, that the check was contingent on some kind of condition or agreement. Is there anything in the record which tells us what broke down on that agreement?
Yes, there is, Your Honor, and I do not remember the exhibit number of the check, but I believe that the there's a cover letter that goes with that imposes an additional condition, which is that we, XL, will hold WCCM harmless from any further developments relating to these repair events.
Did it say that, or did it say we're not liable? You have to agree we're not liable for any more than $125,000.
It was more than that. The contract had already provided that $125,000 was the cap. They wanted us to agree to go back and give them an indemnification in return in case something future came up that they might be responsible for.
Thank you. That helps.
When they did that, when they sent you the $125,000 check, which was drawn on the escrow account, and it had the restrictive endorsement saying it was going to be subject to the settlement agreement, and the settlement agreement had the language you're talking about, was that a breach of the agreement?
No, I don't think it was. I think that was that there were we had done some work at that point. The work hadn't been completed. And the agreement had not been breached because it provides alternatives. One is they fix it. The other is we fix it. If we fix it, we get reimbursed. And so the fact that they said, let's just make this all go away and you can have the balance in the escrow account if you agree to hold us harmless, that's not a breach. That's an attempt to negotiate.
When did XL first submit expenses to WCCM?
I don't have the date that they first submitted, but I have the date that they first incurred, because it certainly couldn't have been earlier than that. And that's found in the record, Your Honor, at Exhibit P33, which is in Volume 6 of the record. And that is an invoice dated November 11, 2000. The other invoices are exhibits P34 through 48, and those exhibits are all later than that date. So the earliest date that we could have had an expense that we had to pay was November 2000, which is less than 3 years before the complaint was filed.
And that's after they stopped the check, which is October 27, 2000.
That's correct.
Okay.
I'd like to briefly address an alternative basis that the court could affirm on the statute of limitations issue, which is the question of whether the six-year statute of limitations that relates to determinable contract damages under 1380.103.5 could apply.
Is this argued in your brief?
Your Honor, it's not, because the reply brief is where the issue first arose, that there was a claim that that the accrual date was inappropriate. And I would just refer the court to the Interbank versus Vail Valley case, which is 12 Pacific 3rd, 1224, which is a Court of Appeals case from 2000. And that was a case that was cited and relied upon by the trial court in its initial determination that the six-year statute applied. It was a case where work was done to put in water taps, and the developer was supposed to get paid when tap fees started coming in. The developer submitted claims for reimbursement. They were denied as untimely, and the question was whether the three-year contract statute or the six-year determinable statute applied. And what the court determined in its discussion beginning at page 1228, I'm sorry, 1229, is that the determinable, an amount is determinable, and so section 103.5 applies if you can determine it on the basis of invoices for which you are being reimbursed. Because that was the method of reimbursement provided in the contract in the Interbank case, and we've got the same issue. We received an invoice. We want to be reimbursed. You can determine the amount from the face of the invoice. And as the court said at page 1230, here the method for determining the amount due to the plaintiff was set forth in the agreements. The 1978 agreement stated that direct costs demonstrated by invoices are eligible for reimbursement. And so I would submit that even if the court were to find that we are outside the three-year period, that the six-year period would make our complaint timely. But I think that the court doesn't have to do that, because the three-year period, we're inside that.
Did he argue the accrual point in his opening brief?
I don't believe he did. If there is something in there, I would stand corrected, and I would agree that we would have waived that point if the court determines it's there. So, unless the court has any other questions, I think that's all I have.
Thank you, counsel.
Please, the court, with regard to the accrual issue, respectfully, counsel's memory of the record and mine may be different, but I think that the record is clear that starting in 1998, the plaintiff in this case started sending demands for action or activity which did not occur. It's also clear, based upon the ultimate record, the costs of Caesar and company, that they were incurring those engineering fees and attorney's fees 97, 98, and 99. So therefore, even applying the 3 years, even if that is the trigger date, this claim was starting accruing much, much earlier than has been suggested. And respectfully, even if we look at that three-year basis, this claim was stale long before that. It also ignores the internal structure of this contract. And something that we can't overlook in this is this had a two-year window for performance. And that two-year window, in which notice happened and no performance occurred, is also a triggering event, whether you apply the two-year contract or statute or the three-year general broader construction. Because there is a two-year window. When the end of the anniversary came and went, nothing happened. That is accrual. So respectfully, I believe that this case should be reversed and remanded. I'm happy to try to answer any further questions.
Thank you.
The expenses you referred to as being incurred in '97, '98 were bills presented to your client for those expenses?
I don't know, because of the passage of time, you know, I got to tell you, some of the underlying correspondence in this was truly jumbled up. But we know that is true, and I'm sorry I'm out of time, because if you go and you look at the testimony of Mr. Duran and others at Joe Caesar, they said that they were incurring engineering fees and costs. And it's my recollection of the record that in '97, '98, '99 timeframe, they said that they had incurred $3,000 to $5,000 worth of engineering fees at that time.
But you don't know if those were presented to your client.
I frankly can't tell you, and we couldn't reconstruct this with that degree of accuracy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. Case will stand submitted, and opinion will issue in due course.